Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hey guys, thanks for joining me for the second part of the Tommy Reichenthal interview. I hope you guys really enjoyed the first part and that you're ready again to hear, well, a story as only Tommy Reichenthal can tell it. In the last episode, of course, we were looking at Tommy Reichenthal's childhood and we were finding out what it was like to be growing up in a Slovakia that was gradually becoming more influenced by its larger Nazi neighbour. In this episode, of course, we're resuming from that cliffhanger from the last episode, where, having been captured and the plans to make themselves safe all in ruins, the Reichenthal family were essentially at the mercy of fate and God and their Nazi.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
The SS Gestapo Masters. It's a terrifying story, it's a harrowing story, and it's a story that contains a fair amount of gory details, not exactly suitable for children, so that's why I've marked it as explicit. It's not because Tommy Reichenthal suddenly goes on a big rant and curses loads or anything like that, it's more because the content I find would be a bit upsetting for the younger kids among us. This episode does go into a good bit of detail about what life was like in Belsen, but it also details what life was like after these horrors, and Tommy Reichenthal talks for a bit on how his life was kind of slowly, gradually put back together after his experiences in Belsen, and how he went from being a concentration camp victim to being a normal person, really. Of course, one of the most surprising things that I didn't know beforehand was that after moving to Israel, Tommy Reichenthal actually fought for Israel during the Suez Crisis, which I guess just goes to show that sometimes even when you don't expect it, things can come full circle. I didn't really want to interrupt him, so I didn't really ask him much about his experience in that, but don't worry. We'll have time enough if we really need to talk to Tommy about that in the future. We conclude this episode on how Tommy Reichenthal came to the decision to talk about what happened to him and how it was that he was persuaded to talk about it. As we'll see, this one experience ends up opening, much to Tommy Reichenthal's own surprise, the floodgates to what would be a reinvention of his retirement. I hope you enjoy it, guys. The next voices you hear will be myself and Tommy Reichenthal.
Well, we were put into cattle cars. This is a trip that I think it was the most difficult moment of my experience with the Holocaust. Because one minute you're living a civilized life, you shower every day, you wash yourself, you eat properly and thing, and suddenly you go into this cattle cart, it's close behind you, and you become like the animal in it. There is no toilet facility, there is in the middle there is a big barrel with couple of buckets that serve as a toilet. Very little water, so you have it for drinking, not for hygiene. People are crying, sick people, old people. From one moment, being a human being, to the next moment, you are an animal. The stench becomes unbearable. There is no privacy at all.
Yeah.
And we traveled like this for 7 days.
7 days?
7 days. And there is a reason for it, why it took 7 days. So when we were traveling, very soon we realized, you know, you hear outside the train sometimes stopped occasionally. They would open the carriage and empty the barrel.
Right.
And then close it again. So you hear people talking outside. So at certain stage of our trip, we suddenly heard, they're speaking all German, the railway workers and everything. So everybody said, we're not in Poland, we are in Germany. So this was the first sign that we're not going to Auschwitz.
Right.
Because we were the first transport of mother, children and old people that didn't go to Auschwitz.
Wow.
Why? Because on the 7th of November 1944, the German blew up the gas chamber in Auschwitz.
Right.
Because the Russian army was nearing,
yeah,
and Auschwitz had to be evacuated, so they didn't want to leave that the Russian will find these gas chambers. So I don't know if you were in Auschwitz.
I was, yeah.
And you can see the gas chamber. They left the ruin there. Mm. I was there as well. They left the ruin. The German blew the dam, not that thing. So they left only the ruin there.
Wow.
And therefore, our train was diverted. Because we were in the train on the 7th of November. And instead of going westward, we went eastward towards Berlin and then up northwards, Hamburg, Hanover, and Bergen-Belsen.
Wow.
So this why it took so long. Otherwise, it would have taken 2 or 3 days. We would have been around. So 7 days. But I found about this only when I researched the whole thing. That we were the first transport. Not if we were arrested a week before, I wouldn't be here.
Yeah.
Because we were the first people that didn't go to Auschwitz. So,
amazing.
You know, the luck.
Yeah.
The luck is Irish, I mean. And Bergen-Belsen. Well, I don't forget the day we arrived. It was raining. It was cold outside November, you know, in northern Germany. Very cold. Suddenly the door was open and we were greeted. We shouted, "Heraus, heraus!" Out, out. And they took us, put us in rows and Then we were marched for about 2 hours. We marched through a forest, raining. We were absolutely soaked. And arrived at night, it was suddenly we saw this big chimney, and the fire was coming out of the chimney. So you can imagine, the adult among us, they thought this is, they know about the crematoria, about the, and the gas chamber. They thought that they are taking us there. So you can imagine the atmosphere. They thought this is the last minute hour that we are walking on this earth. As children, we didn't know. Again, I wasn't taught. But we went to the camp, and you could see the watchtower with the searchlight and the machine guns and the guards and things. All very frightened. We were put, gone to the one of the blocks, and they told us go to sleep. Next morning, we were just told that we are in Bergen-Belsen. We didn't know where Bergen-Belsen was or what Bergen-Belsen was, and that we are in Germany. That's all what they told us. We saw around skeleton. There were no, they were all malnourished. They had shaved heads. You know, that the eyes were sunk into the face. You wouldn't think they were human beings. We didn't know if they were men or they were women, because they had no attributes. You know, they were just skeleton, you know. After only a couple of days, we discovered that we were in a woman's camp.
Oh, really?
And we used to see these skeleton walking around, and occasionally they would fall down, because we were in the area where the hospital was.
Okay.
Hospital. I mean, they were not in the hospital for to be cured. There were no medication there. And mind you, when the camp was liberated, they found a hut full with medication.
Really?
Full with medication, like properly for a hospital. They never used it. The women that were brought in there, they were brought there because they were mortally sick. So we saw these women walking around, and occasionally they would just collapse, fall down. And as children, we used to play outside. We would stop playing and waiting to see if she will get up or not. We knew if she got up, she has another day to live. If she didn't come up, she died. So we actually saw people dying in front of our eyes. As kids, we saw people dying. They forfell, never got up again. That was the end of it. You know, the food and everything, the food was horrible and very little. You can interpret the amount of food we ate. Scientifically, we eat about 2,500 calories a day. If you are in sport or anything, like people that do heavy work, they would eat 3,500 calories, you know. Our intake of calories was between 600 and 700 calories a day. That's amount that you can't sustain life. It's equivalent to 6 water crackers. That was the food for a day. So what happened with a human being? The body begins to eat itself from inside. And you're getting skinnier and skinnier till you become like a skeleton. And finally you die. Bergen-Belsen was not extermination camp. In a sense, we did not have gas chamber. People were not executed there, like mass execution or anything like this. People were dying due to starvation, disease, and the cold. The disease was typhoid. Once you got a typhoid, you got diarrhea, you got dehydrated, you were very, very weak. Eventually you died. If you got typhoid, that was like a sentence to death. And it didn't happen overnight. It's took week two, maybe a month. So it was a very painful death. And I talk about escape from camp. you know, people were trying to escape the camp. In other words, during the night, they would run towards the perimeter. They would start to climb on the barbed wire. The guards on the watchtower see you, shoot you. In the night, we heard the shots being fired. In the morning, you see corpses lying over the barbed wire that were shot during the night. And this was happening every day.
Yeah.
I don't believe, and we don't believe, that they were trying to escape.
They just wanted to
end it all. Yeah. You know, they committed suicide. They knew they couldn't escape. I mean, they immediately see them. Yeah. You know, and, well, this one was happening. People were just ending it.
Mm.
Because they couldn't bear the suffering,
of course,
that they were going through. Their life was very difficult. You know, everything that we take for granted was very complicated in the camp. I describe in one of my stories that I hated the latrine because I was a little boy, you know. Mm. So when I went to the latrine, when I sat on the plank, my leg didn't reach the floor, you know. So somebody had to convince me and hold me, you know, very embarrassing. Mm. But not only this, it was public, you know, for other things. So you could find yourself relieving yourself, another four people sitting beside you doing the same thing, you know. The whole thing was dirty and wet, and I mean the conditions were so. We were there from November, December, January already. The German army was retreating, and they were taking the prisoners. Now in Auschwitz, for example, that was a slave labor camp. There was at any time over 150,000 inmates in Auschwitz. So they had to evacuate. Many of them came to Bergen-Belsen.
Right.
It is estimated over 35,000 came to Bergen-Belsen. Bergen-Belsen was built for about 25,000 prisoners. And suddenly, over a very short period, suddenly there were over 60,000. So the huts that were built for 150, 200 people contained suddenly 600, 700 people.
Mm.
So you can imagine the congestion in a small place, so many people. Epidemic of typhus broke out. And once the epidemic broke out, people began to die in their hundreds. It is estimated that from February, March and up April, per day, over 500 people were dying. About 17,000 people per month.
Wow.
My grandmother died, I forgot to mention, on 7th of March, 1945. She died in the camp from starvation and just gave up, and she died there. And the way she was buried was simple. Two men come into the room. One picked up on the leg, one by hand. They threw on a cart. When the cart was full, they came to one of these piles of corpses outside and threw her onto the corpse. And that was, as a child, I went out to look for where my grandmother was buried. She was buried under a pile of corpses, you know. So we had a crematoria in Bergen-Belsen, but the crematoria was there to burn the corpses of inmates that died.
Mm.
And when we arrived to Bergen-Belsen, the mortuary was actually not far away where we were living. Every day there would be several dozens of corpses there in the evening. A cart will come or a lorry. They would pick up these corpses, brought to the crematoria, and they will be burned. For the obvious reason, the Germans, they were thinking forwards and they wanted to burn the corpses So there was no graveyard or anything.
No evidence.
No evidence. Yeah. They can say nobody ever died here.
Yeah.
But once this amount of inmates were dying in such a hunt, the crematoria couldn't cope with it. So the corpses were just left all over the place.
Oh, God.
And this is these horrific stories when I speak about it, that we used to have sort of a grassy area where we would play, and suddenly there were pile of corpses. So we as children used to run among these corpses. That was our play area.
Yeah.
And we got used to it. These corpses were decomposing and rotting away. You can imagine the smell all around, because the corpses were lying all around the place. It is estimated that on the day of liberation, which was on 15th of April 1945, that there were between 20 and 30,000 corpses outside. So not about open graveyards.
Yeah.
Can you imagine that? And these corpses. So at the time we were expecting liberation, because when the inmates from Auschwitz came to Bergen-Belsen in January, they told us about the gas chamber.
Okay.
We didn't know how it's all.
Yeah.
I mean, the adult among us, they knew about the gas chamber, but they didn't know how it was. So they told us all the thing what was happening in Auschwitz, and they told us that the gas chamber were blown up and that the German army was retreating. So it was only a matter of time that they will liberate Bergen-Belsen. But unfortunately, it took about 4 months from January till 15th of April.
Yeah.
But on 15th of April, we were liberated. I remember the day we heard this noise of workers coming through the camp. So we all ran to see what was happening. In actual fact, the guards from the watchtower, they escaped on the 11th of April. So suddenly we didn't see any guards in the watchtower.
Right.
So we knew that something was happening.
Yeah.
But nobody dared to leave the camp.
Yeah.
They were all afraid that perhaps the Germans set up an ambush or something outside, and once the inmates start to run out, they will start to shoot us, you know. So nobody dared to escape. We didn't have any water because they blew up the pump, the German. Any food that was still in the storage, the inmates went ransacked the place.
Yeah.
So we didn't have any food. Nothing was organized. There was chaos. And when we heard the noise, we ran to see what was happening, and we saw the jeeps were going through, and the lorries and the tanks were coming through the camp, and the British Army was shouting through louder, "This is the British Army. You are being liberated." We didn't even know what liberated means. But we knew that we were free.
Yeah.
There was no celebration. There was no jumping. And because 90% of the inmates were mortally sick.
Yeah.
So they only stood there smiling, realizing this is the thing. And some of the women, Bergen-Belsen was built in the middle of a forest, so some of the women broke some branches from the trees and they threw them at the, you know, because there was no flower, threw them towards the soldier and thing. But it was sort of a subdued but happy ending to the suffering that was going on. But unfortunately, people were still dying after we were liberated. It is estimated that up to 12,000 more people died. And out of these 12,000, they think about 2,000 died because the British Army saw what was happening, the starvation. They left trailers with
food
piled up with army portion. And these were things that are lot of protein and, you know, for the army.
Yeah.
Beef, tinned beef and things like this. Now, the inmates couldn't digest this food, and it actually killed them. And they estimated about 2,000 died before they realized that thing, and they quickly took these trailers away. We were there and kept after the liberation for another 2 months because as quarantine because of the disease. They're afraid that if we get out of the camp, we can bring the diseases out to the civilian population. After about, it was about June, buses from Slovakia, Czechoslovakia at the time, from camp to Bergen-Belsen and picked us up. It took, I don't know, about 2 weeks with the buses till we came to Slovakia. I remember we used to sleep in houses of the Germans, you know, when we're driving through Germany. And, you know, they were so frightened, the Germans at the time. My mother and aunt, they spoke perfect German. And in the houses, they put us in their bedrooms and thing. And we would ask, where you are sleeping? He said, oh, in the kitchen, you know. You sleep in our beds and thing. Well, it was terrible. They all said we didn't know all this nonsense. But anyway, we arrived to Slovakia. We didn't know about my father. My father didn't know about us. In actual fact, we found out of each other. No, we found out in the camp already. Because the first thing that the Red Cross did after the liberation, they began to gather a list of survivors.
Wow.
And this list then they displayed in the relevant countries because they were different countries.
Right.
Know, Poland, Holland, Germany, Slovakia, Romania, Hungary. And all the survivors in the relevant country, they would put the list on the Red Cross building. So they put the list of Slovak and Czech thing. I have a copy of that list. Imagine,
really?
With our name in it.
Wow.
And one of my uncle came to Prague, because it was in Prague, to see if anybody of the family survived. There were over 40 of us taken away. We were the only six of us, five in Bergen-Belsen and one in Buchenwald survived. So when he came and saw the list and he saw us, we suddenly read Judith Reichenthal, Miklos Reichenthal. He phoned my father and said, your family survived.
Wow.
And he said, where they survived? And he said, Bergen-Belsen. So he took a postcard. He wrote, Judith Reichenthal, Bergen-Belsen concentration camp, Germany. And in the camp, we had a big display board where they pinned all the posts that came into the camp. So every day we used to go to see if anything came from us.
Yeah.
So at the time I remember we used to see some people were joyful and happy because they discovered that their loved ones survived.
Yeah.
And then you see some in a very desperate crying and being a terrible state because they discovered the loved one perished. But one day we go there and there is the postcard from my father and he wrote, I'm alive, I'm waiting for you in the village.
Wow.
So when we come back to Slovakia, it must have been beginning of July 1945, well, we met the cousin, he survived, and I remember my aunt kissing him, and but nothing was talked about the husband, you know, father. And she's looking around, where is Jula, you know, where is my husband, you know? And her son said, I will tell you about him. She realized he didn't survive. But anyway, we met my father and was a happy ending to the whole thing. But I was put into hospital in Bergen-Belsen as well after the liberation because I was very, very weak. And if we were not liberated at the time that we were, it was only a matter of time, maybe not a couple of weeks or a month, I would have perished as well. So they put me in hospital, and when I came then to Slovakia, I was sent for recuperation in the Tatry Mountain, you know, fresh air there. And
a
nice place to be, to recuperate, plenty of food and everything. I was there about 4 to 6 weeks. There was no nobody welcoming us as people, as Slovaks. We were in fact refugees because we come from the western part of Europe, which was occupied by England, America and Canadian forces. Slovakia was occupied by Russians. So we come from the west to the east. Therefore, we were considered as refugee people that lived for generations. There was no welcoming thing. There were no doctors or psychiatrists or any treatment for us after trauma that we were to. We come back to get ourselves on the feet. My father got the farm back, and we were also lucky in a sense that we found everything in the house because normally when Jews were taken away, the neighbor or people, they would come into the house and ransack the place, steal everything. But when my father was arrested, one man was put in our house to supervise five Jewish farms that were in the neighboring villages. Our farm and the five additional farms. So he was a collaborator, of course. So when Slovakia was liberated by the Russian forces, which was 5th of April, my father came back. So, of course, this fellow that was in our house, he escaped. So that everything was in it. As we left it, the carpet, the picture of the families were still on the wall, and all the delf and everything was there. And we always say that he was a bachelor, this man. If there was a woman, probably the pictures and everything would have been gone, thrown into the bin, and you know, everything would have been gone from there. But if the house was ransacked, that's what usually happened. Picture of the family, everything disappears, you know, thrown away. So family that survived, they have nothing to remember the family because it all was destroyed. But there were the albums of the thing. Everything was there, you know. Nothing was destroyed. So also in this respect, we were very lucky. Well, of course, I went to school. I was 10 years old at the time when we came from the camp. I couldn't write, I couldn't read, I couldn't do any mathematics. So I had to sit with 6-7 year old kids to very embarrassing situation. I had to work very hard. I wasn't playing like normal children, do the homework and thing. I had to sit with my brother. Learning was very important. We had to learn and think, and eventually I did catch up. It took about 2 years till I was sitting with my own age. And eventually I went to college, and then, of all places, I went to Germany to study. Because I was, my father was a farmer, and my brother became an engineer, mechanical engineer. I liked the mechanical engineering, so we were not cut for farmers. We didn't want to know anything about farming. So my father was very disappointed that nobody will take the farm over from him, you know. Yeah, eventually I qualified as an engineer in Germany. But we stayed in Slovakia till 1949. Because in Slovakia, when we came back, there was still anti-Semitism. The brains of the Slovak people were still poisoned by the indoctrination. They still hated the Jews, and sort of that. I remember when the Jews were coming back, you know, the survivor that coming back, out of a population of 90,000 Jews that lived in Slovakia before the war, only around 17,000 survived. And when the survivors were coming back, the Slovak said, "My God, more of them are coming back that were taken away." So the atmosphere wasn't very welcoming.
Yeah.
And I joined the Zionist movement, and in 1949, I emigrated to Israel.
Oh, right.
And I went to a kibbutz.
Mm.
And then from the kibbutz, I joined the Israeli army. I was in the Israeli army tank brigade. I was a tank driver.
Really?
And then when I was discharged from the army as a reservist, I was called back in 1956 to the Suez campaign.
Yeah.
And I fought for my life for the second time.
Wow.
1956-57, I went to Germany then.
Okay.
And I remember people asking me, how are you going to Germany of all places?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we're talking about 10 years since I was in the concentration camp. But I wanted to be an engineer, and I wanted to get the best education in engineering, mechanical engineering specifically. And the German, they were the people, if you wanted to learn the thing. And I said, I want to get the best education. So all the harm they did, they can pay something back to my benefit. You know? But I always say this thing, that when they were telling me about it, how come you're going to Germany of all places? At the time, the German helped Israel off a lot, and they supplied Israel with lorries and equipment, not weapon, because Germany was not allowed to manufacture at the time, but equipment for the Israeli army and motorbike for the police and everything. And I said, you know, when Ben Gurion, he was the president of Israel, he said when he's going on an official visit anywhere, he would be accompanied by side riders, you know, police. And they ride the BMW motorbikes. So if the president of Israel can be accompanied by a German motorbike, I can go to Germany to study.
Yeah.
You know, that's what
fair enough,
And then something very interesting happened when it was so towards the end of 1959. I was contacted by industrialists from London, and he sent me a letter because one of my cousins was an au pair girl in London.
Okay.
And her boss was a big industrialist. And one day she reads in a paper that somebody is trying to build a factory in Ireland to manufacture zip, and they're looking for a manager to set the factory up. Of course, at that time, in the 1959, Ireland had very little industry or you know know-how of this, so nobody came forward. You know, nobody, because there were no many people that, I mean, when I compare it, when I come here in 1960 and today, this is like two different countries, you know, the advances that happen here in Ireland. I come here, I saw children still without shoes.
Yeah.
And look what the country is now.
Yeah. You know,
and people don't realize that. So he advertised in England.
Mm.
And he had difficulty to get even in England. You know, there was this hatred of conflict between England and Ireland. So nobody came forward to... And my cousin saw it, and she said to her boss, she said, "You know, I have a cousin, he's studying engineering in Germany, maybe he will be interested."
Mm.
So that's, I get this letter from this gentleman. And he said, "I have a proposal, I mean, I'm an engineer, I'm qualified engineer, diploma and everything."
Mm.
He said, "I'm looking for somebody like you. I have a proposition for you. Come to London."
Mm.
And there was a ticket, for airline ticket in the envelope for me. "I come to London, I have a proposition. If we can make business, good. If we can't, you will have a holiday on my account." That's...
You've got nothing to lose.
You know, but I was, 25, 26 year old. I said, "Oh, why not going to see London as well?" I had an uncle that lived in London and didn't see him for years.
Mm.
So I go to see him. And I went to London and he said, he put a proposition to me that he will send me to Italy to learn how to make zips. He will send me to the factory that manufactures this machine, so I will be familiar with the machines.
Mm.
And when I come back, I will set the factory up for him. He said, "If you agree to it, we sign it, and from this moment you are my employee, you will get wages." You know, and this was not wages. I just to give you an example, at the time, a woman earned here in Ireland about £6 a week
in
1960, £6 a week.
Wow.
And men earned about £8 a week. If you were in a little position, you would earn £11 a week. That was a good wage.
Yeah.
I had starting wage £15 a week.
What? Whoa. And
this is from nothing to suddenly getting wages like anything. So I went to Italy.
Yeah.
I stayed in Italy several months because at the time Ireland had a huge unemployment, about 23%. Mm. So coming to Ireland for a foreigner was absolutely impossible.
Yeah.
So my boss had to negotiate here with the alien office and with the foreign office that I'm coming to Ireland, not taking job from Irish. I'm going to create job for them.
Right, right.
And, you know, till they're investigating this thing, you know, because they don't believe you. They think that this is all a story to get you in. So eventually I got a work permit. I came here. It was end of 1959 or beginning of 1960. I can never remember exactly. And I come here, I set the factory up, and while I was here, I met a Jewish girl, fell in love, got married, and I'm here still today. As I mentioned, unfortunately, my wife died in 2003. She had a cancer. We were 43 years together.
Wow.
We had three children, three boys we have, and, now they're adult, of course. They're married. I have six grandchildren.
Wow.
And now the last chapter, of course, is this, what I'm doing today.
Yeah.
I didn't speak about my experiences for over 55 years, not because I didn't want to speak about it. I just couldn't speak about it. I had it all in back of my... back of my head, but I never talked about it. And in fact, my wife, when she passed away, she didn't know much about me at all, because I never told her what I went through.
Yeah.
She only knew that I was a Holocaust survivor.
Right.
When my wife passed away, I had a business in here in Dublin. Because I didn't work for a thing. I had my own business as well. When my wife died, I decided that's it. I don't need to work anymore. Mm. I'm working for other people. I don't need anything. My sons, they all, thank God, got good profession. They're quite successful, and I have no problem. So what I'm working for, I go and a little bit enjoy myself. Yeah. Then around 70-year-old, and but as I am, I can't sit around.
Yeah.
I decided to start to write what happened to me.
Right.
And I wrote a couple of articles for a couple of magazines.
Mm.
Of course, they took the article, they published them. At the next thing, the media suddenly come on to me. And I don't need to tell you what media is.
Yeah.
Anything that they can do, bring something new up, day after you. So
yeah.
I was inundated with journalists, with radio, with television. And the story came out. My children started to know.
Yeah.
They said, "Dad, you never told us anything."
Wow.
They suddenly think. And in one of the school, it was Zion School, one of my grandchildren was there. And he one time mentioned that his grandfather is a Holocaust survivor. So the teacher asked them if I would give a lecture there.
Right.
And, you know, like they invite a policeman or somebody that it's a smoker or somebody that drinks. They invite people like this to, you know.
Sure.
That people should know.
Yeah.
I went there. These were children, 11, 12-year-old. I had no experience of giving lectures
yeah.
or anything like this. So suddenly I'm sitting there speaking about my experiences, no holding nothing back.
Yeah.
Which, of course, these are only children.
Yeah.
But I see 12 kids. They're all crying.
Oh, no.
The teacher is crying.
Oh.
I'm crying. A disaster.
Yeah.
You know? And I said to myself, oh, my God, what will happen now? The children will come home and tell them, and I will get letters and complaints. How can talk to children, making them cry and all this? So I was really worried that
yeah.
I did a terrible mistake. And but the opposite happened.
Really?
Next thing I get from the school and they say, would you come? This is only the class of my grandson.
Mm.
You know? Would you come and tell the story the whole school?
Yeah.
And I said, no, I can't do it. I can't do it.
Okay, guys, I hope you enjoyed the second part of the Tommy Reichenthal interview. Make sure, as always, to let myself and Tommy Reichenthal know what you thought by either sending me a message in any social media form or by sending me an email, wdfpodcast@hotmail.com, which I will happily pass on to Tommy. I'm sure Tommy would love to hear what you thought about it. Would you believe that he was worried you guys would be bored by what he had to say here? And he kept on asking me to cut the interview down to smaller bite-sized chunks. I don't think he really anticipated that I would change it into, well, three like 40-minute blocks, but there you go. I couldn't really do anything other than make it three episodes. The last thing I was going to do was cut out the story, even the bits that he thinks you guys may find boring. I think I speak for all of us when I say that Tommy Reichenthal's story is anything but boring, from the beginning to the end. In the next part, of course, we do some work towards bringing the story to an end. So I hope you'll join me then for part three. Until then, guys, thanks for listening, and I'll be seeing you all soon.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com. Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's UnitedHealthcare insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.